So we're going to have a look at that story of the widow of Nain. I think a text that we could add, well, I've got two texts really. I don't want to confuse you unnecessarily, but I've got two texts. First one is from the Old Testament, which is Malachi 3, verse 6, which is says, "For I, the Lord, do not change. Therefore, you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed." God doesn't change. And then one from the New Testament, which is Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, today, and forever. I'm very blessed that in July, the end of July this year, my middle son got married. Which was good because they were planning to get married last year and had to postpone it. It was slightly, I think they slightly reduced the guest list a bit, but not by much. His partner, Ellie, has a... And it was really nice that not only did they have lovely big gardens, they had a marquee, a moderate marquee. It wasn't a huge affair, moderate marquee, but it was nice to be able to wander around the gardens. And then as an extra bonus, you could wander around the stables and see all the horses. And they are big, I tell you, they are big. The biggest she's got, I think, is about 18 and a half hands high. And if you know horses, that's up here, huge things, beautiful animals. But what I was going to tell you about the wedding was that my youngest granddaughters, Elsie, who's just seven, and her sister Ivy, who's three, were flower girls. And they walked down the aisle with the bride. Now, the bride was early, which the vicar found quite hard to cope with. Well, precious, she's here already, but it was fine. Ellie is never late, doesn't like being late. I thought she might turn up to the church on a horse, and that had been sort of thought about, mooted at one point, but then just decided that with the dress she was wearing and the horse she would ride, it would not be a good combination, so she came by car. But she walked down the aisle with Elsie and Ivy as flower girls, and as they got to the front, the bride and groom obviously went off to stand in front of the vicar, and Elsie and Ivy went into a queue to be looked after by my youngest son, Anthony, and his partner, Emma. And it was lovely. We were sitting just behind them. And it wasn't a long service. I think it was all over in about 35 minutes. It was all done very, very nicely. But Ivy got a little bit bored, as you can understand, because she probably didn't really understand what was going on. And so Emma gave her a book that she'd obviously taken for that purpose. And there was a big stage whisper when Ivy said, "But I can't read yet." Emma said, "It's not a problem. You can look at the pictures." And I thought, actually, that's quite a good demonstration, isn't it? It's a good lesson for us. But sometimes we read the stories and we think, "Lord, I can't understand that." And he says, "Don't worry. Look at the pictures." And the gospel writers particularly, and all the writers, in a sense, they paint a picture. Do you know, I read something and it suddenly came to me that it's absolutely right. I'd never thought of it before. But they said, when you read... even if you read in your head, you hear the words you're reading, don't you? I'd never thought of that. And think, of course it does. You don't just read the words. The words, as you read them, are actually spoken in your mind. And I thought, well, there again, that's a brilliant description of the Bible. But this miracle, which is what it is quite unique in that it's the first recorded time in the Gospels that Jesus restores someone to life. He breathes new life into them. He raises them from the dead with a word. This young man was dead, and Jesus brought him back to life again. But it's also noticeable that, unlike other miracles, there's no mention of faith here, none whatsoever. Jesus often states that because of faith, there is healing or restitution. Earlier in the chapter, in the healing of the centurion servant, Luke 7, verse 9, Jesus, when he heard this, he was amazed at him. He turned and said to the crowd, this is to the centurion, he said to the crowd that followed him, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." So the healing of the centurion servant, there was faith. Jesus didn't heal because of the faith, but it was there, and it was part of the story, part of the action. But there's none here. And it couldn't be, really, could it? Because the young man couldn't have faith because he was dead. His mother apparently didn't show any signs of expecting anything other than now a very difficult life. She was a widow already, and now her son was dead, and he would have been her only means of support. We're not told she had any expectations or faith, nothing at all. So this incident is not a reward or a sign of a reward for faith on the part of anyone. This is really, I say all it is, what it is a wonderful demonstration and example of grace. Soul grace, pure grace, unconditional. Was it God's riches at Christ's expense as an acronym? But when you think about the Gospels and about the Lord's life, he's always shown compassion, particularly to those in need, particularly to widows. I don't know if you've ever read Tim Keller's book, Generous Justice. If you haven't, read it. It's very, very good. It's very, very helpful when considering how to help people. And in that, widows are the first people in what Tim Keller calls the quartet of the needy. The widow, the orphan, the homeless, and the stranger. The law that God gave to Moses to give to the people said that these people would always need help. There would always be these people in society, always be these people in the life of the children of Israel, and they were going to look to them for help. And the Lord also had words of condemnation for those who abused or took advantage of the widow, who was one of the most vulnerable in society. And we don't understand that, do we? Because ever since, was it Lloyd George brought in the widow's pension all those decades ago now, widows have been certainly cared for. Whether they're cared for enough is another debate, but they were certainly cared for. But Deuteronomy 10:17 says this: "For the Lord your God is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, mighty, and awesome God," listen to this, "who is unbiased and takes no bribe, who justly treats the orphan and the widow, and who loves resident foreigners, giving them food and clothing." What's implied there is, of course, there were people who were biased and who did take bribes and didn't take care of the people that needed to be taken care of. Widows come up throughout the whole Bible. In fact, the book of Ruth is a story about two widows, isn't it? Ruth and Naomi. That's all the book is about, really, and God's redemptive plan. But Jesus' action shows that his humanity was in accord with the Mosaic law. Sometimes we forget that Jesus was perfectly human. And so he had humanity, but he also had the compassion that we should have. He was a perfect man, and he was also a good Jewish boy, that he knew his law, and he knew that God had said that these people should be taken care of, and he followed it. And so if we're referring to the law of Moses, we can see that Jesus' compassion for this woman was evident as he helped her in her time of greatest need. So he was showing that I understand the law, and the law says you should look after the widows. This is what I'm doing, and I'm doing it in a way nobody else can. Nobody else would be able to do what Jesus did. They could help her. They could give her financially. They could invite her in for a meal. They could do all kinds of things. We don't know. But they couldn't do what Jesus could do. And so he did what he could do that no one else could do. But he also, while as he is following one part of the Mosaic law, another part he's completely disregarding. And that is, the story tells us he went up and he touched the body, or he touched the bier, the stretcher that would have the corpse that was wound up in. And it says in Numbers 19, "Whoever touches the corpse of any person will be ceremonially unclean for 7 days. And whoever touches the body of someone killed with a sword in the open fields, or the body of someone who died of natural causes, or a human bone or a grave, will be unclean 7 days." Jesus completely disregarded that, so he wasn't interested in this ritual purity. I think it's implied, it's not stated, but in the parable of the Good Samaritan, this is the excuse the priest and the Levite had, if they had been asked for a reason, for not helping the victim. Because if they'd have gone up, to the victim and they'd found him dead, then they would have been ritually unclean. And they would have remained unclean until 7 days, and they'd gone through a ceremonial process to wipe this stain off their body, in a sense. They would have been unable to perform what duties or whatever they were going to do over the next week or so. And whatever they had, it would have been an inconvenience. It would have been difficult for them. But Jesus didn't have to touch the man's body, did he? He could have done it. Well, he raised him with a word. He didn't have to touch him, but he chose to. He chose to touch that stretcher with the body on. And I wonder, looked at in our house group, it was on Zoom, we're looking at a book by Tim Chester called Enjoying God, which is all about the Trinity. Again, as a book choice, as a recommendation, it's excellent. If you want to understand more about the Trinity, get this. It's a wonderful book, and Tim Chester takes you through it, and it's very, very helpful. But he in one sense, he talks about getting out of our comfort zone. And this is what Jesus did. He walked straight out of his comfort zone. He didn't have to touch the body, but he chose to. I'm not suggesting here that we should be foolish enough to put ourselves or others into dangerous positions. But sometimes we should consider whether we're doing what we do because we feel safe and secure, rather than step out in faith as we're told to. We have to consider that, don't we? Whether we want to just the nice quiet life. Yes, okay, we'll go to church, we'll sing, we'll pray, we'll go to the Bible studies. But, oh, you want me to do that, Lord? Oh, I don't know about that. That's a bit iffy, to say the least. I mean, you know, I'll be quite honest with you. I mean, dealing with some of the people I deal with in the homeless community, some of them have big issues, whether it's mental health or drug addiction. And Elizabeth, my wife, is not pleased at some of the people that greet me in the streets. And she's a little bit wary of them. Understandably, you can be. I mean, I love them. But there's always that they can be dangerous sometimes. So, but we're called to step out in faith. Now, I'm going to make a few suppositions here and maybe a little bit of conjecture. And I know we can take that too far, but bear with me. I think this can be certain that one of the first widows that our Lord cared for would have been his mother, wouldn't it? Mary was left. We know that Joseph was there at the birth. And for a few years after, certainly when Jesus was 12, was it, when he went to the temple, Joseph was still around. But after that, Joseph disappears. We're not told how or why or what happened, but suddenly Joseph is no longer in the picture. So it's Mary and Jesus and her other children. And we're not sure how many there were, but there were brothers and sisters, the Bible tells us. So we're left to assume that Joseph has died. And Jesus, as the eldest son, again, a good Jewish boy, would have looked after his mother and his siblings because he was now head of the family. He was the oldest male. And it is suggested, again, please don't take this as gospel, but it fits. It's suggested that the record of the wedding at Cana of Galilee, when Jesus performed his first recorded miracle of turning water into wine, could have been the marriage of his youngest sister. This would explain why after that, he then started his ministry. His final duty as the head of the family was to his younger sister. She was now married. She was off his hands. Another man was responsible for him. Jesus was now free to take up the work that he came to do. I don't know. It fits, but please don't. If you disagree with me, you can say so, and I shan't fall out with you over it. But all his filial duties are over, and he's able to take over and begin his ministry. But this little story has a lot to show us and much to challenge us as well, because it shows how Jesus dealt with people and how we can appropriate and copy his compassion in our lives. I think that's important. A funeral in a society in an age where life expectancy was brief for most people was not uncommon. There would have been funerals even in a village quite often. Infant mortality would have been high, There would have been accidents as well. So we said there was no health and safety in those days, and everything was done manually, wasn't it? And it was a very physical life. And there would have been no thought for any safety at work. I was just amazed. I was talking, we had scaffolding put at our house last week, and I was talking to the scaffolders. Amazing, you know, they use these huge, great steel poles and clamps, and it's all done with health and safety in mind. And I was just saying, you know, when you consider the cathedral in Bury, they would have had, you know, wooden poles, and they would have been tied together. And the number of fatalities they had in building some of these places, I forget how many. They say in the Great Wall of China, there are how many sort of labourers there are in each mile of wall. But that's what they did. When they died working, they just slung them in to add to the bulk, so that the bodies were buried where they died. We don't get that. We live in a world which is much safer. It seems frustrating sometimes, but it's much, much safer. But funerals were all part of the life, if you like. Because we see that in Matthew 11, when they say that when Jesus is talking, he talks that they are like children sitting in the marketplaces who call out to one another, "We played the flute for you, yet you did not dance. We wailed in mourning, yet you did not weep." The children would have pretend funerals because it was part of life. They would all be around and they would see it. And because of this, and it would, men would bear the brunt, I suppose, of the deaths, widows were very common. And there would be orphans as well. In every community, you would have widows and orphans. And this is the world that Jesus lived in. And we can see that his subsequent actions are driven by this compassion that he had. And it was, I mean, it's perhaps an old-fashioned word to talk about, compassion, but it's more than just being sorry or being sympathetic, isn't it? Compassion is a very deep emotion, and Jesus had compassion. And what did he say? He went up to this funeral procession that he met as he was coming into the village. They were probably taking the boy off to a cave in the hills where his father was, to put his body there to eventually end up his bones. And he just says, "Don't cry." Of course, the old version says, "Do not weep, but don't cry." Now, I don't know about you, but we've often said that, especially if you've had children, you'll say, "Don't cry." The child's crying. I can remember many years ago when I worked at Jay's and there were 1,000 people on site, and I was a first aider, which was interesting, to say the least. But also, I was a first aid car driver, so that if we got people that needed to go either to the doctors or the hospital, which was in Bury, then somebody would be nominated. And one day, there was a little boy who was in the nursery, and he could only been about 3, and a table had fallen on him and chopped off the tops of his fingers. They grew again, remarkably, as it regenerates when you're that age. And he was suffering pain, and he was suffering shock, and he screamed all the way from Thetford to Bury. And his mother, she was sitting there with him, and she said to him at one point, "Stop crying and it won't hurt." This little lad wasn't stupid. And yes, it will. Ah, and he carried on. He didn't stop. But you see, Jesus isn't offering just platitudes saying, "There, stop crying and you'll feel better." Whether she realized it or not, he is saying to you, "Stop crying, don't cry, because I'm going to do something amazing." Isn't that wonderful when we think that Jesus comes to us and says, "Yeah, you don't understand this circumstance. This is beyond you. You can't understand why. But I'm going to do something absolutely amazing in your life that you would not believe if I told you." So it would, without any second thoughts, Jesus didn't even have to think of it, apparently. He went up to this woman and he speaks these words so tenderly, yet so powerfully. And then he doesn't say anything else. No need for words. It's actions. And again, isn't that the important thing? So often we want to, I don't know, we try to think of the right things to say when all we need is actions. It's just said that the story of the pastor who went to see that woman who'd been widowed and were left with young children, not just lost her husband, but lost her older children. He just touched her on her shoulder. And it was that grip, that touch that was enough And then, horror of all horrors, attrition to the listeners. Whoa, what's he doing to the people who are around, to the crowds that came with him, and to all the mourners? Jesus goes up and touches the stretcher, the bier that is carrying the corpse, and he just says, "This young man, I'm telling you, get up." That's it. It's a commandment to a dead body. Get up. And what power are in these words? It's the word of life. Speaking the word of life, isn't it? The onlookers didn't understand this, but we know that that's what happened. The one who gave life in all creation. And this is the one who breathed life into the dry bones, if you remember the story in Ezekiel chapter 37. Then he said to me, "Prophesy over these bones and tell them, dry bones, listen to the Lord's message. This is what the sovereign Lord says to these bones. Look, I'm about to infuse breath into you and you will live." And this was all encapsulated in Jesus just saying to the young man, get up. And as he was saying it, life came back. The life force that had left him came back and he sat up and he was totally restored. And he wonderful, isn't it? He gave him to his mother. Whether he physically to hold him, but we're not told. He just said, "Here you go, you have your son back." Everything you thought was going to happen has changed. It's not going to be different. It's going to be different, but it's going to be different in a much better way, because you were looking forward to a very hard life, to total poverty and dependence on other people. Now you've got your son back and he will care for you. But it also had an effect on the people who witnessed it. And I think this miracle is all the more striking, I said, because there was no request for it. It came totally unbidden. It was pure grace. Well, grace can't be anything other than pure, but it was pure grace, nothing more. No one asked Jesus to help. He saw a need. He saw something he could do to help. And so he stepped in. And he acted. Now, isn't that a challenge to each and every one of us? We shouldn't need to be asked. If we see if there's a need, we should be able to step in. I said it's, again, getting out of our comfort zone. We should be able to step in. And we should be able to help. And I think that the people, they said that they remembered, because it wasn't where this happened, wasn't far away from where Zarephath was and where Elijah had restored. And Elijah in another story had done the same thing. And they quickly concluded, these people, that God had sent them another prophet similar to Elijah and Elisha. Now, they were mistaken, but we can forgive them that. They didn't understand. God had sent his people among them. Some of the people may have concluded that this was Emmanuel, God with us. But the words here have a broader meaning. But what Luke concludes with is that this story is that the word, the Logos, the word about this incident raided over the entire region. And that's something, isn't it? That's what we want to happen. I'm trying to think how we could say that there's going to be a shortage of the gospel and people should come in and hear it now. You know, come in before, well, we should tell them that, shouldn't we? Because there is only a limited time. But, you know, look, you know, you think petrol's going to go out, but the gospel isn't going to be here forever. You need to take advantage of it now while you're able. But because of this, and it would have been, there was no newspapers, it would have been word of mouth that people would tell everybody when they met with, wow, we were there. We were there when we were following the funeral procession, and this man stopped it. And next thing we know, he's touched the body, and the body's alive again. And it was a spread. And I think we have to say, don't we, that our desire, the same word, spreads out beyond the confines of these walls. As beautiful as this chapel is, we don't want it to remain inside. We want it to spread out beyond this city and the community around about, beyond the fellowship here. We want it to go. So how will it go? We've got to take it. We've got to take it and spread it, and to fulfill the commission that Jesus said, to go into all the world and preach the gospel. Or wherever you go, be preaching the gospel. And it's not necessarily, as they say, with words, but with actions and just by your very, very presence. And so we come back to our text, one of our texts, which says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So what we can say is that every word and action we read of in the Bible that Jesus spoke, we can take as our own. This is applicable to us as it was to the people who heard it. And Jesus deals so compassionately and tenderly with this grieving widow that he didn't waste words, just don't cry. It's all he said. And Jesus hasn't changed. We've seen Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And he comes to us with the same words, whatever issues we have, and he says the same things. Don't cry. I want to read you an extract from this book by Tom Wright, and he's talking about this passage. And he says, let's go through the scene again. But this time, instead of it being a funeral procession in a small first century Galilean village, make it a moment you most dread in this next week or next year. Maybe it's something that you know is going to happen, like a traumatic move of house or job. Maybe it's something that you're always afraid of, a sudden accident or illness, a tragedy or scandal. Come into the middle of the scene, if you can, in prayer. Feel its sorrow and frustration, its bitterness and anger. Then watch as Jesus comes to join you in the middle of it. Take time in prayer and let him approach, speak, touch, command. He may not say what you expect. He may not do what you want. But if his presence comes to be with you there, that is what you most need. So he may not say or do what you want or expect, but he does fulfill whatever you need. You may not be aware of the need, but Jesus does. Once he is in the middle of it all with you, you will be able to come through it. Now, isn't that comforting? Isn't that wonderful to feel? A simple tale of daily despair, something that they would have been used to, they would have grown up with. Funerals, death was all around them, but such a demonstration of Jesus' power. Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Now, we always need to be talking to Jesus and to the Father in prayer. Of course we do. We're encouraged and commanded to do this many, many times in Scripture. But there are times, aren't there, when we feel so low and we feel so lost, totally lost, if we're honest, and dejected, that these times Jesus steps in unannounced. He knows us. He's a shepherd. He cares for his flock so tenderly. And we can be recipients of this same Jesus. We can live in the reality of Jesus and the Trinity working in and through us. Jesus comes along and with tenderness says, don't cry, just watch. I'm sure you will know this one. This is the dream. And the dream goes like this. One night I dreamed a dream. As I was walking along the beach with my Lord, across the dark sky flashed scenes from my life. For each scene, I noticed two sets of footprints in the sand, one belonging to me and one to my Lord. After the last scene of my life flashed before me, I looked back at the footprints in the sand. I noticed that many times along the path of my life, especially at the very lowest and saddest times, there was only one set of footprints. This really troubled me, so I asked the Lord about it. Lord, you said once I decided to follow you, you'd walk with me all the way. But I noticed that during the saddest and most troublesome times of my life, there was only one set of footprints. I don't understand why, when I need you most, you would leave me. This again takes up almost the same sort of thing in this story. He whispered, my precious child, I love you and I will never leave you. Never ever during your trials and testings, when you saw only one set of footprints, it was then that I carried you. And that is a comfort that Jesus is there. Jesus Christ, the same yesterday, the same today, and the same tomorrow and forever. The man who spoke those words to the widow in Nain is the same Jesus. And he speaks to us today in the same way, with the same love, with the same compassion, with the same grace. Praise our Savior. Let's sing our closing hymn.